March the 31st. We are here to open a work session carried over from March the 30th. And so with that, I will open the work session on House Bill 5071, the Treasurer of Oregon. We have before us Randall Edwards, Treasurer of the State, and Linda Haglund, the Deputy Treasurer. We are convened this morning for the purpose of thoroughly reviewing your performance measures, hopefully with the consensus of the panel, moving those forward, and then turning our attention to actually working on your budget with the idea of moving the budget out today if we agree on the performance measures and the other elements of the budget. So with that, Mr. Treasurer, do you have any opening remarks, and then we'll get right to the performance measures?
I think for the sake of time, we should just go dive into the performance measurements.
Great. And I think, committee, that Ms. Haglund has very generously provided a set of the performance measures. You may have notes in your notebooks that you want to refer to from the original presentation, but at your places are is a memorandum titled Performance and Outcome Measures Revised on 3/30/2005. So with that, Ms. Haglund, if you would introduce yourself for the record, and we'll jump right in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. And actually, this is an exact replica of what you have in Tab 3. It's the same charts, the same order. The reason we revised it was to try to tie it a little bit closer and make it easier for you today to tie it to your spreadsheet. So we've added on the cover page, you can see that there's numbers, so those exactly match to the flow on your landscape form, and we've actually included those on the chart. So that was the purpose of the revision. There was also a couple of errors that we wanted to correct, and I'll point those out as we go through the performance measures.
Thank you very much. Please begin.
Okay. So then on, it's page 10, the first inside sheet of that packet, is chart one, and again, this was our measure of total excess performance over the benchmark. There is an error. This is one chart that we did make a correction on the left axis. We got a little over anxious with the zeros on the original chart and had an extra set of three zeros. So the numbers were correct as far as how they were posted on the chart. The axis was different, so we just cleaned that up. Did you want me to go and explain each chart again?
I think for the purposes of moving us through this, even though you have done this once, these were rather sophisticated performance measures tied to some national averages, and I think it would be useful if you could continue to do them in detail.
Great.
Senator Morsette.
Well, I really appreciate this, and yesterday I did not have my original notebook. I made the mistake of taking things out of my small one and putting them into a larger one, which I could not find. And that, now I can take a look at the notes that I'd made earlier and understand, you know, better what you're talking about. So I just wanted
great.
To
good.
Maybe I could just give a little background, Madam Chair, on
please.
Some of the, a lot of these standards that you see here, the benchmarks that we've set out, that are industry standards. In fact, the benchmarks that we measure our performance against are put together by an usually outside consultants that work with us to determine what's the appropriate benchmark. What, as Linda mentioned, the common one that you hear a lot about is the S&P 500. We do not have that in here, but my point is that's an example of looking at the appropriate type of benchmark. Others help us determine that, in which case we adopt those, and that's what we hold our managers to, as we hold our staff to. It's the benchmarks by which we try to beat. And that's really, these are all benchmarks that are, we're trying to beat these relative benchmarks so that we get a higher performance and measure not only staff performance, but also the people who we hire to manage.
Great. And I'll just continue then. On chart one, and again, I'll just highlight for you, we did also add the chart number to each of the charts. You'll see at the top left corner. And again, that ties back to your landscape sheet. So chart number one covers on an annual basis the excess performance of the portfolio over the portfolio's benchmark. And we're showing on the left axis the excess performance over benchmark, and that would be the dark bars are the values there in millions. And the lines show the actual charting of the benchmark's performance as well as the performance of the portfolio. Are there any questions on the chart that I could answer?
Go ahead.
Chart two?
Next.
All right. The second chart is our performance for OPERF over a three-year period. Again, it is comparing the performance of the portfolio against the benchmark for the portfolio. And that's the difference on those two lines. And you're seeing the spread there is actually the difference in the performance between the benchmark and how the portfolio performed. The difference in these two charts, this is three-year rolling returns. So at each year-end point, it's the prior 3 years. So it's a bit of a longer-term perspective of the portfolio and shows, I think it's more reflective of the value that the portfolio is providing over time because it smooths out some of the volatility in the benchmark, or I shouldn't say in the benchmark, in the actual markets themselves.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How about it?
Yesterday I raised the question about why are you using benchmarks that are market-based, and I guess the answer would be in reference to Representative Krupp's question about your investment decisions. Is that what we're basically talking about here, whether or not... I mean, what are we measuring in terms of your performance by these benchmarks is what I'm trying to get at.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, in the investment realm, the market benchmark, let's stay with the S&P 500. It's a basket of 500 stocks.
Yeah.
And it reflects the performance of those stocks in the market with nobody making any decisions about them. So it is a starting point with no human intervention.
Yeah.
So that's why we're using those benchmarks, is that's what the market did. Then we overlay on top of that our decisions, the investment council's decisions of what managers do we want to have in the portfolio. The portfolio that we were looking at yesterday was the collection of managers for domestic equity. So on an aggregate basis, how did those managers do? How did we do in picking those managers relative to this no-thinking benchmark how the market did?
So may I?
Please.
I was just clarifying how these benchmarks, what they have to do with their decision-making, and she was explaining that. So what the conversation that we had yesterday with Representative Krupp in questioning your decision-making in terms of the managers and the policy of what we're really... performance measures are geared toward that. So is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I'm trying to... I just want to be sure that the benchmarks... Okay, I understand the benchmarks. The performance measures have to be geared toward your performance, basically, and the wise or unwise decisions that you make. And so as we go through these various charts dealing with investment, that's what we're doing, is making a judgment on your prudent investments, I guess. Okay.
Maybe I could just shed a little light on the process by which we select people because to manage
yeah.
money. Because really what we're talking about are my staff works with consultants to go out and find people to help manage money. So there's a pool of folks out there, they cull it down, and they make a recommendation to the Oregon Investment Council. The council here has a presentation made to it, staff makes a recommendation, there's a debate, and then if we all are in agreement, we hire somebody.
Okay.
So you never really know, as is always the saying, the past doesn't predict the future, but you can see kind of what performance made, what they've done in the past. So once we hire them, then we put them strap them with a performance measurement and my staff to monitor their performance. And so there is a decision-making that my staff makes, as well as once this manager is hired, they have to monitor those managers. And if they're underperforming, then we do eliminate them. So we have to hold my staff accountable. We have to hold the managers accountable. That's what these benchmarks really drill into, at least the first eight.
Okay, and may I... I will.
Yes.
Thank you. This is, having been the first, you know, this is the first time I've been through this. In general, I have not had the pleasure of being on a Ways and Means subcommittee, and it is a pleasure because you learn how the world operates from the inside. And I'm wondering if when you do the benchmarks, there can be more clarity, I guess, in terms of your oversight. So we understand, or at least I understand better, why you have that as a performance measure. I know it is a benchmark. It's tied to a benchmark. But I guess I want to know more clearly how I can judge you in your performance. Now, we had that discussion yesterday, I thought, and it was a thorough discussion, or the day before, and you explained in great detail why you stay with a particular position that you've taken in the market. That was a good discussion, and I think that obviously relates to what we're going to be doing today. So I, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have to go in great detail again. I don't want to have to repeat everything that you've done. I just had to get a better understanding of why we're doing these things. Okay.
Representative Krupp, you look as though a question is posed on your lips.
More just a comment. You know, I am indeed very pleased with the returns and the performance of the treasurer's office and how they've been able to manage the money. The particular fund that is chart number 3 is the one that I was referring to yesterday that had a 32% growth in 2003, which is again outstanding, and obviously has dropped off to about 11% in 04, which is about the same as what you articulated yesterday for the Common School Fund. There's $17 billion in that fund in 2003. There's more now, at least according to the report that you had. There's $8 billion in 2003 in the International Equities Fund, which had over 40% return. And if you turn to charts 5 and 6, you see that alternative equities and real estate returns were not quite as good in 2003, although still very good, but have been markedly better in 2004 than the previous two funds in terms of overall performance. And I only point that out to you to note that if you go back and look at the Common School Fund, it lost money for 3 years prior, if the charts that I had seen yesterday were accurate. And which pretty much follows many of these funds because they're market-driven funds. My only point is to say that because these funds, which have massive dollars in them, are based on a different strategy of investment, produce greater returns. And if the rationale for not being more aggressive with the Common School Fund is that you have a lower risk tolerance for that fund, it still lost money for a number of years prior, and a more aggressive strategy would recover that money more quickly, which was my entire point yesterday. And we don't have to go down that road again. It's something I want to continue to explore with the Treasurer's Office in ensuing times here. Again, I am very pleased with the results of the Treasurer's Office and am not in any way suggesting that they have not done a good job. I'm very pleased. I cannot laud them enough for what I think is work well done. I just have a differing opinion. I think that they could produce greater returns on the Common School Fund. Thank you. That's the only comment.
Well, against this backdrop, I want to just take the temperature of the committee. I had discussed with Ms. Hagland and the Treasurer their willingness to go through these performance measures one at a time to make sure that everybody was comfortable. And they had agreed to do that. I think I hear a growing consensus that now that we've had an opportunity to put them in the context of your book and we've talked about them a little bit more, that there may be a willingness of the committee to move past this and agree to the performance measures and then get into actually working the budget. Have I interpreted that correctly or incorrectly?
Madam Chair, I'd like to talk about the last two performance measures, though, dealing with the staff and customer satisfaction, I believe. Whatever.
Okay. Do you want to pose a specific question, Senator Morissette, or would you like Ms. Hagelin?
I would like them to walk us through those last two. Customer satisfaction and hours of training. Sure. Just give us a rundown, if you don't mind.
Ms. Hagelin?
Madam Chair. Yes, that would be charts 24 and 25. 24 is the measure of our customer satisfaction survey. So this is the survey where we go out to people who use our services. So our board members, local governments who use our services, bond counsel that we work with on issuing bonds, agencies, et cetera. And this is the overall rating. And the chart actually, we discussed this in phase one, it runs from low to high. So the scale is actually zero is low and five is high. We do it annually, save 2003, and you'll see that note actually in your revised packet. We did add a footnote. We did not do a survey in 2003. And we have added on your spreadsheet for chart 24, you see in column 5 and 6, we have actually indicated what our target is, and our target there is to have a 4.0 rating from our customers on a roll-up aggregate basis.
Is that responsive, Senator Morissette?
Well, that's less than, Madam Chair, that's in 204, you had higher than a 4 point. So why are you lowering your expectation?
The survey itself, and this is where charting versus what work is going on gets difficult. The survey has, it's a 5-position ranking.
Okay.
So they can pick from 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. So to actually, someone that's picked a 4 is very satisfied. A 5 would be extremely satisfied. So for us to always get over 4, you have to have a whole lot of 5s. So it almost the scale skews what you're getting to. I would agree with you. It makes it look like we're setting the bar low, but the function of the survey would require a different set of responses. And I think that we should be very happy as the agency if we had the majority of our customers very satisfied.
Please follow up.
Please either change the bar or put a 4.5, put a half. If you're going to mark a halfway mark, then at least have that on your survey or change the bar so it doesn't look like you're lowering the standard. I mean, that would be easier to read.
Agreed. And we're learning in this process also.
Yeah.
So appreciate the input.
Thank you.
Any other questions with respect to the performance measures? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have a performance measure for the Common School Fund? Could you maybe?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, in the performance measures you're looking at, we do not. In the past, the set of performance measures that was approved preliminarily by the committee last session and that we've worked with is only OPERF. And I would certainly be receptive to the committee looking at the mix that we have here, and possibly we could eliminate some that are for OPERF and bring other portfolios forward.
Maybe I could respond to that, Madam Chair. Senator Morris. The investment strategy for the Common School Fund has been a complete passive strategy. It's an indexed bond fund, it's an indexed stock fund, and an indexed international fund. So if we hook the benchmarks, we're just going to be at the benchmarks. And I think Representative Krupp's raising the question, can we do better than that? And I think one of the reasons we could begin to look at changing our investment strategy there is the size of the fund. It's fast approaching $1 billion, which it hadn't been for years, and that was sort of the strategy earlier on, was try to grow the fund, nurture it, and get it larger. using just a passive market approach. Now I think we're getting to a point potentially where we could add some either active management or enhanced strategies, which then you could benchmark it. But I think it's still a little premature to throw in, which is the way we've benchmarked all of these strategies, which are all, these have an active component in it. There's somebody going to be making some judgment better than the market, and hopefully that performance will, as is reflected in the returns that we've had, greater than the marketplace. So people are beating the market for us on average. We've seen that happen. So I think right now it might be a little early to put that in. I think the idea, though, makes some sense, and we can develop that and bring it back.
I think Representative Kirk raises a very valid issue, and that is, why would this common school fund be held to a lower standard of volatility than a retirement fund would? And to look seriously at what the criteria is, and I assume it's the Treasurer, Secretary of State, and the Governor that sets this criteria.
The investment council works with them, and us, I should say, and my staff. And, again, the bogey that was set up for the PERS fund is 8%. The initial bogey for the Common School Fund is, I believe, 5%. And the reason for that was the Common School Fund had been very small. And so there was a strategy to try to be conservative and grow this fund without taking bigger bets, which then you'd see swings, which is part of the reason why we were trying to keep some consistency in cash flow, because there's every biennium we put out two payments out to the Common School Fund, through the Common School Fund. So there was some balancing between stability and growing the fund.
Right.
That was that investment strategy. But I hear your point. We're not trying to not hold that account, nor the other funds. The safe fund's another one. It's in fact a $3 billion fund, and I don't believe we have a benchmark for them. So, right?
The council has benchmarks. So let me just draw, Madam Chair, if I may. We've chosen to highlight the retirement fund, but for all the funds that we manage, the investment council has a similar set of benchmarks. So we could have, if we wanted to cover the same detail for all the funds we manage, we could almost replicate pages of the same type of information. In the past, the interest has always been focused on the retirement fund.
Any other? Senator Morrison.
Are you finished with that?
Yes.
Okay. I just have a comment on the last benchmark concerning hours. Is this, are you reporting an activity, or are you reporting a goal that you are trying to achieve? I mean, it looks like you're listing an activity here. What's your goal in this benchmark?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the goal is, and I'm struggling to get on the same wavelength term here, we want our employees to have 20 hours of training. That would be perfection of meeting the goal. If you look again at your spreadsheet for Performance Measure 25, we have a target of 75% in 06 and 80% in 07.
Okay.
What the performance measure is measuring is training activity. So the individual staff member attending training, so receiving additional schooling information.
Okay. I don't know. May I?
Oh,
okay. A suggestion on some of these goals in terms of quality, because we're trying to measure quality and not quantity, so 20 hours is fine, and it would be, I don't know how you would break it down among the employees if there are certain things that you want them. Is there a certain kind of training? I mean, just training, does that, I don't know what that means. I mean, you don't define the quality of the training that they're getting, and that would be helpful to know what you're trying to achieve by the 20 hours of continuing education. I guess the thing that I've always struggled with in benchmarks, and I had a bill in 99 that would have started these, and I used to get all kinds of feedback that you can't measure quality when you're dealing with benchmarks. We're already doing benchmarks, which measures more, I think, the activity that we're trying to reach. I don't want to talk about activities. I want to talk about the quality of what you're trying to do, which is not always easy to measure, but it would depend on the types of courses. Some ways. I don't know if you can work that into benchmarks, but that would certainly help us.
Madam Chair, certainly not on the fly.
Maybe just for the record here, you could give us a flavor for the kinds of training that you're... are you cross-training so that you have staff capable of performing many functions in your office? Are you looking to advance people's professional skills in a certain issue area? Maybe you could give us just a flavor for the kind of training that you're doing.
Certainly, Madam Chair. And that is an excellent question. This chart does not include any kind of cross-training. The training here would be individuals going out and completing their CFA, their Chartered Financial Analyst, which is a three-year self-study program that is an industry standard for investment professionals. So it's a very high level of training that makes them better in their job. It plays back to then our performance in the funds. Individuals in our IT shop, information technology shop, going out and taking training in project management, ways to do development life cycles, run our projects better. Banking, we have individuals going to external training and getting certifications for cash management. There's actual certifications for those different functions. So these are going to outside professional training settings.
May I?
Please.
I would appreciate it if you could detail somehow the kind of, just what you mentioned, because that helps us understand what your goals are, and it seems to me that would then be a motivation for people to achieve that, because it is something that you are measuring and you want to. I don't know how many people don't have these. I don't know what the goal is in terms of having everyone in a particular area achieve a certain point, but if you mention this as a performance measure, that would certainly be a motivation for people within your department to want to get that training. I mean, that seems to me it would be a help to you, and then that way we're talking a quality benchmark.
Senator Morsette, could I maybe offer a suggestion that their benchmark right now reflects just training across the agency, and that rather than making the benchmark so complicated by talking about the different kinds of training, that in their next budget presentation they could just attach an addendum that would give the next panel reviewing this a flavor for the kind of training that they were doing.
Thank you. Could I follow? I want to separate the benchmark from the performance measure, because I don't want people falling back to benchmarks. Benchmark is a level. I think it's measuring something different. I think that's a good idea. I would like to see some indication of what it is you're talking about when you're dealing with training. That, to me, is a performance measure.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Without taking away from any other state agency or department, you folks are dealing with highly, highly specialized staff with high levels of expertise. And what I keep struggling with the training measure is, how do we keep from being the training ground for people who are going to leave? How do you balance that?
We haven't gotten into that issue, have we?
Exactly.
Well, could I just speak maybe very high level? Training, as I said earlier, we have, as you described, high professionals in my organization. One of the ways we keep them is actually through training. Mm-hmm. I mean, we keep them hungry in their jobs by keeping them up to speed on what's going on. And again, because we interface very much with a very complicated financial market, who also have very highly trained people, it's how we work. Just in our IT department, informational technology department, we're really one agency that spends a lot of time in training with our staff, because there's a lot of change, security issues. I mean, we're trying to wrestle with the internet. How do you make sure? We people are trying to hack into us all the time,
right?
And so. Mm-hmm. We're having to keep that up. So where that plays out for us, as Linda described, it one helps keep the staff, I think, on the cutting edge in many ways. It keeps them interested. We've been blessed by having a lot of people who want to stay there at our agency. I mean, that's one of the ways we do keep them. And it helps us do our business. The bigger issue you're describing is how do you keep a public employee and a salary in the end versus what many of these folks could make out in the private sector.
Can I just play this just follow up, please? Without putting anyone on the spot, can you just share what's the salary difference between your portfolio manager and perhaps the counterpart they're dealing with back in New York?
A lot.
multiples.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars difference.
Okay, and I'm not meaning to take up time, but it's something I'm struggling with. If I'm an employee of yours, I could see where this would be a great 5-year investment for me, and I'm heading back to New York or somewhere else, knowing that I'm going to take my level of expertise and my knowledge of the state of Oregon's portfolio and go make a heck of a lot more cash.
Maybe, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there is actually something also that we offer, which is a unique opportunity. I mean, just to manage the amounts of money we have, is that in the private sector you wouldn't see a lot of an individual overseeing that much money. I mean, and you say, well, what's the risk there? I mean, the fact is we have to have good professionals who can oversee this. So there's opportunity to really put your own mark in many ways on these portfolios. We've hired the other way. We just hired somebody in our private equity who came from Wall Street, I think, who sees an opportunity to develop themselves. The question whether an employee stays how long and professionally, that's an individual decision, but traditionally the Treasury's had people stay for years and years and years, and maybe that becomes more of a challenge with our generation who tend to want to stay in a job much shorter for other reasons, but so far we've been able to balance that.
Just one last point, and I don't have the muscle to pull it off, but you do. I really believe in comparable worth, and you know, when we look at Pilates pay schedule and when we look at Kohler's and some of those, they earn every penny of it. I would care to argue that if you looked at what your staff is carrying on their shoulders, there's an argument to be made for a special classification of employees. That's all I'll say.
Representative Fakian.
I would guess, and tell me if I'm wrong, that regardless of the amount of money people can make, some of your folks just find some intrinsic value in public service.
Yes. You bet.
I do. We haven't talked about my salary.
I wasn't going there.
We're
going to tie ours to yours.
We're all in that same boat.
Senator Morris has a question that hopefully will lift us from this topic and move on.
Well, no, it's just a comment. It's really the joy of coming before the legislature that keeps it coming.
There you go.
I know. It's all about us, Senator, isn't it?
All right. Well, on that note. I think I hear a developing consensus around the performance measures as presented. I am going to submit the question. Whoops, we've temporarily lost our quorum.
And Madam Chair, may I help fill that void?
Please.
For you? Since I'm getting the sense we're not going to go through each of the measures, and
That's
I indicated
correct.
That there was a couple of changes in open disclosure, I did want to highlight a change in case you got back to your desks and saw a difference. It's in chart 9.
Okay.
And pension bonds are just reflected more accurately now in this chart. And the issue we had between what you had in your notebooks and here was two different dates.
Can we not just throw out all the old charts?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good. All right. Thank you for that correction. As soon as we regain our quorum, what I intend to do is to ask the consensus of the committee that we add the best business practices measure. I believe you're already doing that. I think we have continuing enthusiasm to try to make sure that your council and any other advisory boards are fully engaged. I have every reason to believe they are. But I'm going to ask the consensus of the committee to add that as another performance measure and to work out the exact language and report it back to the joint committee on audits. And then we have two other issues that I believe your staff has discussed with LFO, and that has to do with the TANs and the non-limited other funds, and I will ask Dallas to comment on that as soon as we get our quorum back. And then, unless there are objections from the committee, I'm prepared to move into actually moving the budget out. I have reason to believe that Representative Smith is just outside in the hall. He has not gone far. Representative Krupp is testifying. And as soon as we can get one of them back into the room, we will proceed ahead.
Did you move to...
Yeah, actually, Dallas has prepared, and it is at the committee's place.
Just yours, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Some comments on any of the other performance measures. And in an attempt, and I think Senator Morissette has pointed this out, to make sure that they are absolutely relevant to the legislature, if we could combine with a target that's more universally understood, and I would just offer 1 through 7. The individual components of the employee's retirement fund. I think we've touched on this, but a benchmark that more fully speaks to the performance of the whole retirement fund. And I don't expect you to do this on the fly right now, but that might be something for your consideration.
And could we pose that then when we're, are we still scheduled to go to the...
Joint Legislative Audit Committee, mm-hmm. Yeah. During the interim, we could work on that.
Great. That would work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you need a consensus from the panel, too?
We can put that in the budget report, Madam Chair. If my understanding is correct, you're approving the performance measures, but we're recommending that they come back during the interim to prepare, not only to update the where they're at with respect to the benchmarks of are they ahead during the interim, with the individual ones, but also maybe an updated looking at the collapsing some or making possibly, you know, clarifying one on the training.
Well, I think Senator Morissette has raised a very interesting point, and that is while many of your performance measures guide your decisions as managers and in your work with the Investment Council, I think for the purpose of clarity in coming before the legislature, to have benchmarks that speak, for example, through 19 through 23, talking about the Oregon College Savings Plan, maybe adopt one overall measure for the plan. And I think that you're hearing in Senator Morissette's comments just some thoughts about pithier measures that are not this level of detail that would be part of a presentation to the legislature that would allow one panel to the next session to track how's the Oregon College Savings Plan performing. And so I might just recommend with the agreement of the panel that that would be something that you could work on with LFO and come back to the Joint Audit Committee.
Absolutely.
Is there any objection? Okay. Then I think because we have operated largely by consensus with respect to other decisions, unless there is objection from any member of the panel, that we would accept the performance measures as drafted and presented by the Treasurer and Ms. Haglund, that we would add the best business practices measure and ask you, Ms. Haglund, to work directly with LFO to refine that language so that you've got something that you don't have to make up on the fly. I think we have put in the record the kinds of things that we're looking for to make sure that your commissions and advisory boards are fully engaged and are reporting back to the legislature in the form of a governance letter that they've actually reviewed your legislative presentation and are reviewing your financials and your performance routinely. But because that's what you do, I think that we just wanted to make sure that best business practice is included. Ask you to look at perhaps some simplification for measures 1 through 7 with respect to the Public Employees Retirement Fund and see if we can have one measure directed to the total performance of the fund, and then in 19 through 23, one measure or a presentation that would speak to the performance of the Oregon College Savings Plan. And so,
and if I might, Madam Chair, to pick up on Senator Morris's comment, I think we could begin to look at exploring as well a common school fund measurement and potentially the safe measurement too.
Good. Good. All right, and so we'll leave that for you to work out the specific language, so we're not doing it on the fly here. This is too serious to catch you that unawares and ask you to come up with thoughtful language. So a quorum is present, and unless there is objection from the panel, that will be recorded as our consensus with respect to the performance measures.
Do you need a
Do you want to vote?
Not necessarily. If there are no objections, we can record it without objection.
Great. Okay. Then that takes us directly into your budget, Mr. Treasurer. And I know that there were two outstanding issues that you, your staff had discussed, or maybe you, I don't know if you were involved or not, you and your staff discussed with Legislative Fiscal, and that included the treatment of the TANs and the treatment of the non-limited other funds. And I'm going to ask for comment from our professional staff about what those discussions produced and for reflection and comment by the committee.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with respect to the recording of the interest on the tax anticipation notes, that is still being discussed. There are a lot of issues, whether to put it up with the revenue forecast or we actually record it. We've heard pros and cons. That's an ongoing discussion. No decision. I wouldn't recommend adjusting the treasurer's budget at this time or anybody's budget at this time. It's a little early in the game, and there are a lot of policy issues that need to be worked out. So we will still continue to be working on that with other agencies and with the co-chairs, and I believe also with the Legislative Revenue Office. So we would not propose any adjustment to the agency budget with respect to that.
Set.
With respect to the non-limited, moving in under the expenditure limitation, we have had a discussion. We don't quite see eye to eye because Legislative Fiscal hasn't changed its recommendation to move those expenditures from non-limited to limited, and I think Treasury still feels that it would be happier and more comfortable if it didn't have that under the expenditure limitation. But we have had discussion. We have I haven't personally talked to both co-chairs. I have discussed this with one and explained our recommendation and the rationale, and that co-chair was satisfied with that explanation. So I've received no pushback, if you will, from co-chairs on this issue. We are doing this again with other agency budgets. Not every expenditure that has previously been non-limited do we intend to recommend be put under limitation. But for these transaction costs and operational costs, we are proposing that those types of expenditures do be put under limitation. The Treasurer's Office has, we made an adjustment, a recommended adjustment to what was in the budget for this to try to accommodate for more recent knowledge of the transactions and expected volume to try to accommodate it.
Dallas, because I have been moved by the Treasurer's argument, I'm going to exercise a prerogative of the Chair and ask the Treasurer again on the record to make the argument. I think that despite the fact that LFO has made a recommendation and the co-chairs, at least one of the co-chairs, appear to be synchronous with that recommendation, it could still be within the purview of the committee to recommend another direction. But I want to make sure that before we get into a position of acting against the advice of Legislative Fiscal and the agreement of one of the co-chairs, that we at least have a thoughtful discussion of the case that the Treasurer is making. And I would invite you, Mr. Treasurer or Ms. Aglin, to make that case again for why the Treasury may be somewhat unique with respect to these other funds and the level of how cumbersome it would be to come back to the emergency board were it moved into limited.
All right, just take a first shot at it and then have Linda really fill it in. Really, we're just making a business case, and it's not about being happy and comfortable. It's actually, we believe that this is the best business for the state of Oregon. We've had this authority for 20-plus years now. It allows us that flexibility to pay for things that are unexpected. For example, and it's really our banking services are the core business that we really, I think, if we had some opportunity to maybe negotiate, because there's investment services that we contract out that we feel that we could move underneath our limited budget. But the non-limited, with the banking services, we really have no control over how many checks are going to be written, and basically we have to pay those. So there could be some friction. I guess the point here is there could be a frictional point where we'd have to shut down check payments, which I made the same case to both the co-chairs, so I'm just telling you the same thing we said to them, whereby we would be stalled in potentially paying bills. And all I'm saying is from a business point of view, it doesn't make sense. And from a policy point of view of what you're trying to get at statewide, I think I understand what you're trying to get at with non-limited. But I think we've got a pretty strong business case. We mentioned the one co-chair that Dallas just spoke about. We had talked to him. I think he still has an open mind. There may be some exceptions to this along the way. I don't want to speak for him, but my point is, I think we've got a very good business case as to why, on the banking side particularly, we would still like to see that as a non-limited.
I would just like to share with the committee my own experience having run a portion of what's now a freestanding state agency and how cumbersome it is for agencies to actually get onto the emergency board schedule. A great deal of paperwork has to be submitted much in advance, and it is consuming of staff time to make the preparation and then staff time to come for the appearance at the emergency board. And the timing to get on the agenda is at great length. And I don't know whether or not with your the example you made not knowing the volume of checks, whether or not your timing and your business situation would fit the timing to get on to the schedule for the emergency board.
My fear is it wouldn't, Madam Chair. And I guess that's my point. It's why I take that risk. And I think we could give you the numbers. The banking side of it is 3.5 million of the 6.2 that we're requesting, and then the 2.7 potentially could be moved under the limited. That one isn't quite, I mean, we're more comfortable with that being put here. I mean, from a business point of view. The other one, the banking one, we really don't have any discretion over that. That's the customer, is totally customer driven.
Representative Smith.
I would share with you, Madam Chair, I'm open on this issue, and I'd leave it to you to go.
Buck the co-chairs by yourself?
Go ahead. I'll be right behind you. So that way when they shoot, I'm in front of you. But wherever you choose to go on this.
I would be very comfortable with the proposal you just made by the treasurer. That part of it goes into limited and... those elements that really we don't control, you have to do it, stay in the non-limited.
I agree.
Okay, and as do I. I am very sympathetic to the LFO recommendation with respect to other agencies, but I am very sympathetic to the business case made by the treasurer. I've never done this before, Dallas. A, be in a chair, and B, bucking the co-chairs. So give me a little guidance on where we go from here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before me the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendations, which mirror pretty much what was in the... We've discussed this with Treasury, and in their presentation yesterday, as they walked you from their recommended budget that was proposed to what they were asking for, it's the same dollars. The only difference between the two now is the amount of non-limited. So I guess for purposes of a motion, you would move to adopt the LFO recommendation with the exception that 2.7 million remain be moved to under limitation so that 3.5 million of it be non-limited. And so that, let me rephrase that, because we will adjust the budget, the bill, that the expenditures for banking services will not be subject to limitation. And that's, if you look at, if you have your copy of the budget bill, there's a section there, and I will read it to you so we'll get it on the record. Section 2 reads, for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2005, expenditures made by the Treasurer of State to pay for cash management and investment services are not limited. I would recommend you would change that to read, for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2005, expenditures made by the Treasurer of State to pay for cash management services are not limited. We would delete the words and investment services. That would leave the banking services non-limited. And so you would adopt our other recommendations, that wording change, and then the budget report would reflect the movement of 2.5 million in the budget from non-limited to limited and leaving 3.7 million as non-limited expenditure authority.
Are we in work session?
Yes, we are
in work session.
Do you need a motion?
We do need a motion.
I'll provide you with that motion to
move what I just said.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I want to make sure that we've done this way. Anne-Marie, you've got the full text of Representative Smith's motion. Okay. All right. Just a comment, Mr. Treasurer. Is this acceptable?
I want to thank you very much for moving this.
Okay. All right. So we now have a motion to accept the LFO recommendation with respect to House Bill 5071, with the change that we are moving expenditures for banking services to not be subject to the limitations. Okay. And in this case, we need to do an actual individual vote, do we not?
I don't believe so.
Okay, without objection, then.
I just want to share just one comment. My motion, my vote, will be subject to you still standing, obviously, when we go to full. So I'm prepared to help you with that here.
Thank you.
We're right behind you.
Yeah, right.
We're with you, boss.
How come my hands are sweating? All right, then, without objection, we have adopted that recommendation. Okay.
Next one would be then to move approve amendment of the bill and move this to full with a recommendation that do pass as amended.
Because so okay, Representative Smith moves that with that amendment we pass House Bill 5071 to the full Ways and Means Committee with a do pass recommendation.
As amended.
My earlier comments still
right.
stand.
Without objection, and with Representative Smith's comments noted, we will need a carrier in full.
Representative Crump, I think, would love to.
There you go. I don't like sticky people in this room. Senator Morris has volunteered. That's happened to me too many times.
I was going to say.
So Senator Morris has volunteered to carry this on to full.
To the House and to the Senate.
And Senator Morris will carry it to the Senate and Representative sure. Avakian to the House. And so with that, Treasurer Edwards, thank you very much for your appearance. Ms. Hagland, it is always a pleasure to hear your presentations. They are uniformly professional and comprehensive, and I appreciate your patience as we carry this over until today. So thank your whole staff, too, for a good presentation. Great job.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 5071, and we will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5033, Government Standards and Practices Commission. There will be an opportunity for public testimony, and I believe there's a sign-up sheet on the table. We will have the presentation of the GSPC budget with particular focus on the performance measures. We welcome as LFO staff Ken Rocco. We welcome from the Budget Management Office Satish Upadhyay. And Mr. Hearn, good morning.
Good morning, Chair Johnson.
We would invite some opening remarks from you, and then I think we'll jump right into your performance measures with the hope that in the remaining 55 minutes of our time together that we can move your performance measures forward to the co-chairs.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'd like to also point out that the Vice Chair of our Commission, Carl Visentainer, is present with me today. Fortunately, he lives in Salem. As opposed to
Mr. Hearn, may I interrupt you, please? Would you introduce yourself for the record and introduce your board member again and ask for the spelling of your last name, sir?
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm Pat Hearn, Executive Director of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Also with me today is Vice Chair Carl Visentainer. Spelling of that name is Visentainer. Chair Johnson, when I was here the first time, you asked that we prepare a list of issues, was the way you stated it, for further consideration. And I have prepared something in response to that. I'm certainly not going to read it verbatim, but I would like to point out the issues that are on there. They've all been mentioned in our previous appearances here. And the first one, of course, is agency staffing. The level of agency staffing, which certainly ties directly to our budgetary resources. The next issue that I've pointed out is relates to statements of economic interest, and it's kind of interesting. I did a somewhat hurried internet survey of filing requirements in other states. I found that some states ask for about the same level of detail that Oregon does. Other states ask for substantially more. And California leads the pack with a form that is 32 pages. However, not all filers have to file all pages. It's kind of like schedules on an IRS return. But I was somewhat indicated there. And I found only one state that does charge a fee for filing, and that's the state of Ohio. And it ranges from $20 for a local school board member up to $65 for a state elected office holder. I was not able to obtain any information as to how many filers there are and what kind of revenue that generates.
May I interrupt you, Mr. Hearn? Representative Smith.
Thank you. Can you give this body a little bit of historic information? What was the legislature's intent on a statement of economic interest?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, it's my understanding that the intent and the purpose was to provide public disclosure of the economic interests of designated public officials.
I need to expound on economic interest. What's that mean?
Well, I think if you, some, Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, some states call their forms, as an example, a personal financial filing. Oregon's calls it a statement of economic interest, as you all know, because we all file those forms. The Oregon form does not ask for any dollar amounts. It does not ask for any value categories or anything like that. It asks for stock ownership over a certain amount of money, membership on board of directors of some private entity, any business engaged in with a lobbyist. It's economic interests as opposed to personal financial resources.
I'm struggling with this committee. I think we have an obligation to do this correctly, and I think you folks have an obligation to show us how to do this correctly. And if statutorily that we're limiting you from doing that, you need to tell us. I'm sensitive to this, and there's a reason I'm sensitive to this, because I want to do it wrong. And I guess I need some guidance on how to do that. And I think there's 89 other people in this building who need guidance on how to do that.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I appreciate that. The conclusion of my memorandum to this subcommittee includes some recommendations, and one of those recommendations is to select some kind of an interim committee or work group to come up with solutions to these issues that I pointed out, and statements of economic interest is certainly one of those.
Okay, please continue.
I also, there's been discussion in our past appearances before you relating to agency-provided training, and fortunately I was able to obtain some information from the Internet on agency-provided training. I found that all agencies provide statewide training on a regularly scheduled basis. You can go to their website and you can actually see when and where training is going to be held. Most states have just a general training relating to their law. However, some have specialized training, like such as training for lobbyist registration and reporting, training for statement of economic interest filing, that sort of thing. And I also would like to point out that all the agencies that I surveyed, and again, this was a somewhat hurried survey via the Internet, but they all provide their training free of charge. The next issue is lobbying regulation. This biennium has caused a new awakening or a new realization about some issues related to Oregon's lobbying registration and reporting statutes. And I think the rise to this, the impetus that gave rise to this was the much publicized investigation last year of the Safe Corporation by our agency. But the largest issue is that Oregon's lobbying registration threshold requirements are either one of 24 hours engaged in lobbying activity in a calendar quarter or the expenditure of $100 in expenses for purposes related to lobbying activity. So it's a voluntary reporting and a voluntary monitoring type effort so that there's really no way to know when or even if someone has reached those thresholds. But by quick example and illustration, we did have a case that arose during the 2003 session with a lobbyist that represented three large entities on a very large bill, a high-profile bill, and came to our attention that in parts of three different calendar quarters during the 2003 session, this lobbyist was never registered. A complaint was filed with the commission, and a preliminary review and investigation ensued. In one quarter, she reported to us in response to the investigation that she expended 15 hours, and so she didn't get to the 24 hours and have to register. In the second one, she reported that she went to 20 hours, so she didn't get to the 24 hours and didn't have to register. But the interesting one was the third quarter, where she reported 23 hours and 18 minutes toward the 24 hours that requires registration. There's no way to know whether the 24 hours is reached or whether it wasn't. I think it's clearly obvious that that kind of a report is pretty close. I mean, especially if you're not keeping detailed records. So I think, in other words, that we need to review, the state needs to review these threshold requirements and come up with something that perhaps is easier to control and easier to observe from the standpoint of regulation.
Mr. Hearn, I don't want to interrupt the flow of your presentation, but I'm going to.
All right.
Just to ask you a question about the SAFE work that you did. Who initiated that request to you? What was the trigger mechanism that engaged you?
A complaint that was filed by Senator Vicky Walker.
Okay. What I'm trying to distinguish is that was a massive undertaking on the part of your very small agency. And I'm trying to see whether or not I'm confused about whether or not a legislator triggers an investigation, a citizen triggers an investigation. While I don't disagree with the work that you did or the request that Senator Walker made, I'm curious to what level you would be responsive to an individual legislator's complaint asking that you do a detailed investigation of an agency. And I don't know if I've parsed this so tight that you can answer that.
Well,
how do we avoid making you a part of the staff of a legislative office in undertaking an investigation of an agency?
Chair Johnson, I've really not given this much thought, but I think aside from some kind of special legislative provision or guidelines, I don't think that I mean, when I receive a complaint from a legislator, it doesn't undergo any different scrutiny than one that comes in from the average citizen.
Okay, you've just answered the question. So the complaint stands on its own merits, regardless of its origin.
Chair Johnson, correct. As a matter of fact, if I may follow up just to show you the flip side real quick, we did in fact receive a complaint from a couple of legislators following the SAFE case, complaining about the lobbying reporting of the SAFE's opposition group, if you will. And in that particular case, we were not able to come up with enough evidence to move forward on it, and we did not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Morsett.
Thank you for your answer, because I was hoping that you would view each complaint on its merits and not on who made the complaint, and you answered that question. Thank you.
In our previous appearances, we've also discussed public meetings law, and I mentioned to you the lack of enforcement for the public meetings law, the areas such as adequate notice, quorums, meeting without giving public notice, and that we get a great many inquiries from the public wanting some kind of remedy for what they sense to be violations of public meetings law by their local officials, and there is no remedy. The only remedy is for them to file a lawsuit in the circuit court, and when we inform them of that, they react with understandable dismay. And so I think it's time for consideration to be given to whether or not there should be some kind of administrative regulation of public meetings law. And then finally, the Law Commission project, and I put that in there because we don't know what the scope of that's going to be, although I anticipate it's going to be significant. And it could or could not impact the overall need or for budgetary resources, but I think it certainly needs to be monitored and watched. And that leads me up to recommendations. And
let me stop you, Representative Smith.
Can you go back to the public meetings law? That seemed awfully vague to me.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, Oregon's public meetings law has various requirements, such as adequate public notice of a meeting. It requires that if a quorum of a body is going to get together and discuss the agency's business, that they have to give public notice to it. Then, of course, there's the requirements relating to the taking and recording of minutes of the proceedings of a public body. And then there's the executive session provisions of public meetings law. That's the body of law that gives the specific purposes for which a governing body may meet in a closed or executive session. That portion of the law is currently enforced by the Government Standards and Practices Commission, just the executive session provisions. The rest of public meetings law relating to minutes, notice, quorums, etc., has no enforcement attached to it other than for an aggrieved citizen to sue the governing body in the circuit court.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsett.
There's one part of the executive session law that is not enforced, and that is if the reporter violates the executive session and goes out and makes a direct report of what happened without speaking to someone before they do that, and that's happened in the state of Oregon, and there is no redress for that.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morsett, that's correct. There isn't.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions for a solution to that problem? I know there was one small jurisdiction where they simply would not go into executive session if a particular reporter showed up, and that's terrible for them to have to go through that. So it's an irresponsible individual who's violating that law, and there should be some way of dealing with that.
Well, Chair Johnson and Senator Morrison, I certainly think there could be some sort of amendment to the statute that would provide for a violation and the imposition of some sort of sanction under the law for reporting executive session proceedings when they're not supposed to be.
Please continue, Mr. Hearn.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. And finally, we're recommending that a couple of blue ribbon committees or work groups, whatever they might be called, be appointed by the Legislative Assembly or that the Assembly direct the formation of. The first group would be suggested be composed of one or more members of the Assembly, representatives of local government associations such as the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Counties, school boards, etc., the executive director and one or more members of the Government Standards and Practices Commission, one or more attorneys who specialize in government law, representative of Common Cause, League of Women Voters, and the Law Commission. It would be envisioned that the tasks of this group would be to review statement of economic interest forms from Oregon and other states and identify amendments that could be made to the form to improve its usefulness, review how the Government Standards and Practices Commission provides training, identifying possible alternatives such as training staff within the agency, audio video productions, and training others to train, review public meetings law to identify if other provisions than executive sessions need enforcement, and if so, who should do that enforcement, and then finally monitor the Law Commission's review of ORS Chapter 244. I would envision that these activities could occur during the 2005-2007 interim with periodic reports made to either the Joint Audit Committee or the Emergency Board. The second group...
Really, really...
Representative Smith.
Thank you for indulging me on this, Madam Chair. Back on the Statement of Economic Interest, can you send to my office some type of historical summary on what they wanted, the legislature wanted? I mean, is it to know what your career is? Is it to know what your assets were before you started in the legislature or in public service or the legislature, either one, and what they were afterwards? I want to know what's the point that we're trying to get at in this forum.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I'll be happy to research that and give you whatever I can find. I mean, I wasn't here then, and I don't have first-hand knowledge, but I'll certainly search the legislative history.
Okay, that's it. But
I think that's very helpful. You've asked the key question, what are we trying to accomplish here? Not to know if you own 25 shares of Boeing stock.
Exactly.
But rather if the ownership of the 25 shares of Boeing stock could somehow influence your discharge of your legislative responsibilities.
That's right. I think this is great, and I think we could clear this up.
The second work group that we're suggesting would be composed of one or more members of the Assembly, representatives of the Capitol Club, the Department of Justice, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and the Money and Politics Research Action Project. And what we would suggest that this group might be able to do would be to review lobbyist registration laws and identify amendments that would enhance lobbyists' understanding of when registration is required and make it possible for the commission to identify violations, and to review lobbyist and lobbyist entity expenditure reporting requirements and identify possible amendments that improve the quality and value of the information on those reports.
Mr. Hearn, the only comment that I think I would make in response to that is that your comments and what you've written here, I think, presuppose that we're dealing with a body of professional lobbyists. I think we're very fortunate in Oregon to still have a process that's sufficiently open that a citizen can come in here in an unpaid capacity simply because they're passionate about the advocacy of a certain issue and find themselves accidentally exceeding all of the requirements. I want to make sure that whatever we do reaches out to those citizens who still feel that this building is open enough for them and their ideas to come and be heard, that we include some education outreach so that they understand what their responsibilities are and we don't lead them into being crosswise of the law simply because there was no information available.
Good point. Thank you. It could certainly include such persons.
Thank you.
Can I play off that really quick?
Representative Smith. Especially if you're going to say good things about it.
Well, I think I am. Joe Q, citizen, walks into the building, becomes passionate, spends hours and hours in here. I assume it's their obligation to learn the law. Is there anything in this building for the person walking through the door that says, you may want to check this? How does Joe Q Public know?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I'm not aware of anything other than there is information down in the lobby message center, but of course the citizen lobbyist isn't ever going to get down there. So
about the kiosk? The little center thing there?
There's nothing there I'm aware of. We could certainly provide it. May I just quickly follow, because I think it might help you understand a little more. Just spending time in this building or spending time sitting in committee hearings does not count as lobbying. It doesn't accrue toward that 24-hour threshold. What accrues toward the 24-hour threshold is one-on-one meetings with legislators and or legislative staffers and or soliciting others to lobby the legislature or their staff. So I think in the real world, if you stop and think that you're able to give persons who care 5 and 10 minute bites of your time, and that's about it, it takes a long time to get to 24 hours in a calendar quarter if it doesn't count sitting out here. So, it's a pretty liberal threshold, I believe. And I think the average citizen lobbyist probably doesn't get there. I'm sure there are a few.
Mr. Hearn, I would just suggest from my experience, and I think there's enough legislative history among the three of us that are sitting here, the example that I would use to guide my thinking is Michael Tolley, who came into this building with a idea that he was passionate about that ended up in legislation to make it a felony to kill a cab driver. And Michael was not affiliated in any way with anybody. He was just a cabbie with a good idea that in the response to some murders of his colleagues and friends, came to this building. And I'll dare say he spent more than 24 hours because he spent at least that much time with me. but his experience might be what we would use as a guide to or a measuring stick against which to judge citizen lobbying. He may have been sitting out in the hallway, but he was there opportunistically waiting to get somebody's ear to convince them to support his legislation. So he would be my yardstick.
He must have been very passionate.
Well, he was, and he ended up with legislation that was passed and signed and is now law.
Passed more bills than most of us, probably.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, I'm Carl Vicentainer, Vice Chair of the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and appreciate the opportunity to visit this morning. I'd like to add a few comments to Executive Director Hearn's recommendations here, particularly regarding the two Blue Ribbon committees or panels that he talks about, to which I give complete support for a number of reasons, including the fact that the Oregon Law Commission has an ongoing project with an eye towards the next session, coming up with recommendations as to substantive changes in the law, perhaps.
If I could interrupt you,
yes,
just to help edify our discussion.
Yep.
The Law Commission has a proposal before the legislature to ask for some additional funding that may or may not be successful. And I want to make sure that we keep that in mind before we set up a superstructure relying on the Law Commission to perform a task that I believe they've been asked to do so by the governor, among others, to make sure that nothing that we decide here is contingent on something that may not happen with respect to their budget and ability to discharge the request.
Madam Chair, good point, well taken. And that was not my meaning at all.
No, I know that.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make sure that the rest of the panel was aware of the fact that a lot of stake is being put in, or a lot of stock is being put in the Law Commission's ability to perform certain services with respect to your issue areas. And should they not receive an adequate appropriation from the legislature, that may or may not be able to be accomplished, or that's my understanding at least.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee. My point is that, independent of that, coincident with that, it would be a benefit, but not necessary to the total benefit of having such studies as outlined being done. I would like to add to that, if we don't come up with a satisfactory alternative funding for the GSPC this session, which I think is probably statistically likely, that we add that task, either via another committee or as an assignment of one of the two committees proposed, that exploration of alternative funding mechanisms would be part of their requirements, so that we are better prepared and in place at the next session to address it more adequately.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I have no difficulty with additional funding if I know what the vision is, if I know what we're trying to get at. And I'm struggling here. I want to know particulars. Every day this panel reviews bills from agencies and departments that they bring forward their recommendations, their suggestions, better ways to operate their functions. And I don't see that. I see us punting the ball. And it bothers me that we're doing this on the 1st of April, because I feel like we're punting the ball on second down.
I'm Chair Representative Smith. I felt that way as well. And being a political amateur, I do recognize that a political reality, the fact is that it is late in the game when the game plan has had a fairly limited and restricted developmental phase.
Well, just
I'm being anticipatory towards resolutions this year not being to everyone's satisfaction. And they may be pessimistic, and that's the ninth beatitude: blessed is the pessimist, for he shall never be disappointed. And if it's pessimistic, that's fine. I hope I'm wrong.
I'm hoping that we don't have to do any of this, but I think probably we will.
Fellow Representative Smith.
I appreciate that, and please know I appreciate your service on this commission, because I understand that this is public service. I sit in a unique position because I'm also chair of campaign finance reform for the House, and I'm sitting here with one vote on your budget, and I want to see specifics. Bring the ideas. I have a difficult time saying, yeah, let's just throw more money at a position. I want to know this is what this position is going to do for us. Let's talk.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I see two issues. One is that looking for specifics as to the budget, it would seem to me, and Executive Director Hearn can speak more cogently and specifically to it, what we're talking about here is restoration of service. We're not talking about new ideas. We're talking about performing at an adequate level our obligations to the citizens of Oregon, which has greatly been impaired in recent years for lots of reasons, most all money. And we're trying to get back to being able to adequately address those the mission and those responsibilities. The other issue is how can we do this better in the future? And I'm not sure that any of us is adequately prepared at this point to satisfy either my or your requirements of specificity as the real ideas.
Just really quick, and then I'll move on. If you folks aren't prepared, how do you expect us to be prepared?
Senator, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't expect you to be prepared. I expect the opportunity to assist in better preparing ourselves and in preparing the Assembly to adequately address this through the use of work groups or committees, whatever.
I'll do whatever I can to work with you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, that's all.
Mr. Hearn? Oh, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many statements of economic interest are received? Mr. Rocco has supplied us with a list of the cities, counties, state.
Chair Johnson or Senator Morse, approximately 4,000.
Approximately 4,000. And is there any fee charged?
No.
At this point in time? Thank you, Madam Chair.
A follow-up on that. Have you ever broken out the cost to your agency to process those 4,000 statements? I don't know to what depth you review them or read them or follow up where there's lack of clarity.
Chair Johnson, it's in the earlier binder where we...
I apologize if you touched on that, and I just don't remember.
Mr. Hearn, I think based on the prioritized list, they did break that out, and it was, their staff do many things, and it was just an exercise to try to estimate how much time they spend on these, and it was approximately 0.3 FTE of their... of their 2.8 FTE, roughly about $57,000 out of their governor's recommended budget of about $763,000.
Thank you.
That's just a rough estimate, however.
Thank you.
Just refresh my memory because I don't remember. These are annual filings, aren't they?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morse, yes.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you. I've completed my review of the memorandum. Attached to it, you have two items. One is a summary of legislation that has been introduced this session relating to the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Senate Bill 420 is the first one. There's been one hearing held on it. I don't anticipate it's going to get any legs and go any farther. That is the one that would impose the assessment on public officials and every governing body to try to get revenue to fund the commission with. The other one is Senate Bill 550, introduced by these.
May I interrupt you? What informs your decision that you don't think it's going to go any farther? You said that rather definitively.
I apologize for that, Madam Chair. It's just that it's been 2 months and no further actions occurred.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 550 was introduced by the Committee on General Government. It does several things. It has not yet been heard. It prohibits legislators from receiving consideration for lobbying other than their legislative salary. It deletes the provision allowing the removal of contested case hearings to Marion County Circuit Court, increases the maximum civil penalty from $1,000 to $10,000, and deletes the provision requiring award of attorney fees to prevailing parties following a circuit court proceeding, contested case hearing, or appeal. House Bill 2939, introduced earlier on March the 9th, basically by the House Democratic Caucus, would increase the 0507 appropriation for the Government Standards and Practices Commission by $91,500 over the governor's recommendation. House Bill 3291 changes gift limits, changes the reporting requirements on limits of food and beverage, and specifies that the exemption for food, lodging, and travel for public officials when appearing in an official capacity at an office-related event does not apply to legislative staff. And I must say, I was not involved in the drafting of any of these. I really can't share with you any history on them. It's unknown to me. I could do some conjecturing, but that's all it would be.
Mr. Hearn, isn't this, though, an area that has been the subject of much engagement by your agency, the whole subject of out-of-state travel?
Chair Johnson, there was a case approximately 5 years ago involving three members of the Legislative Assembly who had traveled out of state, and the issue there was that their airfare for the spouse of these legislative officials was paid for by the host organization. The exemption that currently exists in the law provides that exemption only for public officials, not relatives of public officials. In the ultimate disposition of that case, a judge ruled that the spouses were volunteer legislative officials. Accordingly, they were public officials, and therefore the exemption also applied to them. So when I indicated I could conjecture, that was probably what I would conjecture.
I think there continues to be a great deal of vagary around this issue. As I understand it, if lobbyist A wants somebody to go to their industry convention, they cannot pay the legislator for the travel, but could make a contribution to the legislator's campaign fund, and the legislator could then pay for their own travel. Is that correct?
Chair Johnson, no, it is not.
Okay, would you then help us?
Sure. If the legislator was being invited to go to the convention to participate, you know, give a legislative analysis or whatever, he would be appearing, he or she would be appearing in their official capacity in an event that bears a relationship to the office, and the food, lodging, and travel could be provided without limit. It would only need to be reported on the legislator's statement of economic interest. That exemption for the food, lodging, and travel, however, does not currently apply to relatives of the public official.
How about if I'm going to go to a convocation of other legislators, like NCSL, National Council of State Legislatures? Can a lobbyist pay for me to make that journey?
Chair Johnson, yes.
Thank you.
The last bill I wanted to mention is House Bill 3292, introduced March 15th. It still hasn't been heard. It establishes directs the commission to create the filing of lobbyist statements via the Internet, increases the frequency of filing during legislative session from 3 times to 7 times, requires itemization of any expenditure made for a legislative or executive official over $5, and modifies the content of lobbyist registration statements.
Mr. Hearn, I want to go back to a familiar theme that Representative Smith has sounded over and over again, and I think I probably can speak for all of us. Our interest in wanting to follow the rules, just needing to know what the rules are. And it seems to me amazing that you can pay for a $1,000 plane ticket, But tonight I'm going to a meeting of city and county officials, and it was my plan to take, for the benefit of some cities that I represent, copies of the new blue book, copies of the legislative directory, and someone stopped me and said, no, that could be interpreted as me giving gifts. I'm just, and those publications have a de minimis financial value, but they're very valuable to the cities I represent to have in their mayor's office. Help me understand how this all works.
I gave one of those plastic State of Oregon pins that cost 35 cents or something in the bookstore to a page one day and was cautioned that that could be considered a gift.
And see, we pass those out routinely on the floor of the Senate. My colleagues have bags of them in their desks and are giving them away to little kids that are there.
And still doing it even after the caution, but I'm guessing that that would not be considered some kind of a problem. I didn't mean to get in the middle of your example, well, but it is. It's a question in many respects around the building.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chair Johnson, the fundamental nexus of the law that we're talking about here, Chapter 244, specifically 244.040, prohibits a public official from using their official position for financial gain for themselves, for a relative, or for a business that they or a relative is associated with. It doesn't at all address the public official using their position for their own financial detriment. That's not prohibited.
That's a good thing for all of us.
So it's okay to give your pin away or your blue book or whatever it is. I mean, as far as there being any impact of ethics law, there would be none.
Okay, but if I throw emery boards or pencils out of a car during a campaign, I'm in trouble.
Chair Johnson, that's an elections law issue, and I can't respond to that. I have no knowledge of it.
Okay, that's a good point. Thank you.
When are legislators running and when are they not running?
Yeah.
And then the second and last attachment, Chair Johnson, is an internet survey I did earlier.
Actually, that's important enough that I'd like you to say that to make sure that it got picked up by the recorder.
Well, wait a minute. And it begs the question of when are legislators running and when are they not running?
Does the campaign season ever end?
Well, for not some, for the, probably not.
Not for the governor.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I think what we're really striving for is that we all want to be proactive and not in trouble after we've strayed into some place that we didn't mean to go, purely from the lack of clarity in the rules. Anyway.
Well, Chair Johnson, I would like to respond here just real quickly on one thing. In the early 90s, I was routinely asked to participate in the orientation of freshman legislators, and I gladly did so. And I would bring our guide for public officials, and I'd pass it out and spend an hour and a half or 2 hours with the members, and I'd answer all the questions that I could so that at least there were some seeds planted there. That invitation hasn't been extended to me since 95 or 97. I don't know why, but it just hasn't been.
Why wouldn't you feel it incumbent upon yourself to come and say, or to go to all 90 offices and to the statewide elected officials and say, I'm here, here you go, would you like to take 5-10 minutes and discuss this with me?
Chair Johnson, that's a good point.
Or even better, here's my DVD, here's my CD, and you're welcome to watch it. That's a piece of your presentation that's lost on me, why it is that we're taking your very valuable time to drive out to Heppner, although Heppner's a great place, and that was a lousy example, to drive to someplace not represented by anybody on this panel, to do an in-person presentation when, if curricula was developed and DVDs of your smiling face doing the presentation, you could get it disseminated at a much deeper level than worrying about, do you have enough money in your budget to drive someplace?
Madam Chair, members of the panel, if I may respond to that with some personal history. I was adjunct professor of marketing at Chemeketa College, was being the operative term, and audiovisual aids were available to us, and they were of great value from an instructor standpoint and from, as a student now, also from a student standpoint, a very significant part of the exchange in communication was the interaction, the one-on-one, the individual questions that flesh out the large outline. However, budget constraints removed that position, and it went strictly audio-visual. So the students no longer have an opportunity.
Senator Morset.
I don't do DVDs and CDs when I get these things that I'm supposed to watch and look at. I just don't. Rarely do I do them. I think someone has to be on site. Someone has to interact. And putting it on a CD or a DVD or whatever is not going to do it.
Senator Smith, last comment, then in the remaining 15 minutes, we've got a couple of other things we need to do.
You bet. I appreciate that perspective. I truly do. I get that because I'm the person that would be asking the 20 questions. But at least you folks could say you initiated the contact, starting at the special district level to the cities, the counties, all the way up the line. And I would feel very, very comfortable if you folks came to us with a package that said, here is what we need to do to make this work better, rather than we need more money for a position to make this better. I'd love to have you come and address point by point and say, you know, in terms of education, if we had X dollars, we could do X outreach. If we had X dollars, we could do X compliance. We could do this. I don't see that.
Representative Krupp has convinced me this will be minuscule.
It will. Madam Chair, because I've been testifying on one of my bills in another committee, have you discussed Ken Rocco's memo here?
We have not, and that's a perfect segue into saying, Mr. Rocco, would you care to comment?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify that today it was intended to be a public hearing, a phase two public hearing, purely to have Mr. Hearn respond to some questions from phase one and to provide some information on the governor's recommended budget. So what we're going to try to do in the last few minutes here is review the governor's recommended budget and a couple other items that I provided. One is just a basic background memo that Representative Krupp referred to, and there's also a packet that you should have that includes a list of the public official subjects who submit an annual statement of economic interest and a copy of the guide for public officials that the Government Standards and Practices Commission produces that is, I think, available on their website, but we have provided copies to you here. And these, both of those items were in responses to earlier questions from phase one. And then we also have an item from budget management that we'll go through that describes what is included in the governor's recommended budget and public testimony, which there is a sign-up sheet.
Okay. Then I think we'll move right into Mr. Padgett's budget management presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Dr. Padgett of the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be providing you a broad overview of the governor's recommended budget. And you all should have a copy of the presentation handout in front of you. And keeping the time factor in mind, I'll be very, very brief. If you turn to page 2, you will see the governor's recommended budget for the entire administration program area. And the thing to note on this is the Government Standards and Practices Commission, their budget is very small. It is less than 1% of the recommended budget for the entire program area. This budget is mainly funded with general fund. The functions of the Government Standards and Practices Commission, it supports the governor's principles relating to government efficiency and accountability. As you've heard before, the governor has outlined six principles for budget development. Moving on to page 4, this budget is mainly funded with general funds. There's very little other funds that there are charges that the agency requires people to pay for cost of publication. And now on page 5,
72% of the budget is personal services, which is cost for salary, wages, and other personnel costs, and 28% is services and supplies. Moving on to page 6, if you look at the last far right column, you'll see that the budget is a 25.6% increase from the recommended, the likely to be approved budget from 2003-2005. That's mainly because during 2003-2005 there was a reduction of 1.20 for full-time equivalent positions. Those positions had to be reduced to balance the budget due to the general fund revenue shortfall. The major policy issues facing this that we considered while developing the budget. The governor recognizes the importance of this agency's functions, and the budget enables the agency to sustain minimum level of services. What the budget does is it restores the 1.20 full-time equivalent positions that were reduced during 2003-2005.
Thank you, Mr. Pudgett. Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In relation to Ken Rocco's
actually, Representative, could I ask you to hold your question? I have done a great disservice to two members of the public who have come to ask to testify.
Okay.
We will have a chance to visit with Mr. Pudge again when this comes up, and I would like in the remaining minutes to ask Ms. Weatherston and Ms. Miller to come forward. I don't feel quite so bad about Sarah because I let her sneak in back when she wasn't supposed to testify. I'd like to go ahead, though, and get Ms. Miller's comments on the record. She's been sitting here, and I apologize to you.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. For the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. I hadn't planned to testify today, but there were so many things I saw that I thought I could answer and clarify. I guess I'm somewhat have become a policy wonk of sorts on this issue. In the 2003 session, Common Cause was either instrumental or obstructionist, depending on your view, in some lobbying reform. So I've taken a particular interest in the statute that we're talking about, which is Chapter 244. What I'm noticing in your questions to Mr. Hearn and to his commissioner is that your problems are with the statute, not with the agency. And so if you have these questions and problems, you need to address the statute. Representative Smith, Senator Johnson, Representative Smith, this is an excellent document you can get from the Law Commission. And it talks, this is the Code of Ethics Project report from the Law Commission. It analyzes all these questions in the particular statute 244. What the problem with this project, and I pointed this out to the commission and to the governor's office, it does not include...
May I interrupt you, Ms. Miller? I'm going to go ahead as chair and take the responsibility for getting copies of that for the whole committee so we're not all calling them individually.
Wendy Johnson.
Please continue.
Okay. The project does not include a review of the lobbyist function, which I think is really a mistake, because I said the lobbying function is what brought that legislation down in 03, and you cannot, if the lobbying function is going to be housed in the GSPC, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, then you need to consider it in the context with this Law Commission review. So in defense of the commissioner who said we really need to find out what's going on and before we you're saying show me the money, and they're saying show me the money because they have to have the money to run their agency to show you what you want to see. I just thought it would be a lot easier for you to understand what their challenges are when you realize that they have to do these things by statute. They aren't arbitrary. And so it's like, why is the GSPC doing this? Well, because of 244. I think I had a few more comments, but I can pass it to Sarah.
Representative Smith.
I appreciate that, the comment that statutory, not agency-driven. Am I wrong by assuming, though, that they ought to take a lead in sharing with this body where the fundamental needs lie in correcting the system?
Who's the chair now? Sorry, are you the chair?
Senator Morris.
Senator Morris. Chair Morris, Representative Smith. Are you wrong? I think you're wrong in one sense, and that is the punt analogy. You're going to punt. If you're referring to the two blue ribbon panels as the punt, I recommended that to the governor's office at the end of the 2003 session. It was punted, really, to the law commission and put on halt till 07. So it is not the agency's fault that they don't have these answers, because they were basically said, and we were told, don't bring this up until 07 and the law commission comes back. So in terms of the training function, that would be a question of for these panels or some review, maybe just a legislative committee, to say this is what we need from this agency. But you know, you guys are hammering on the statute, and the agency can't do anything about that.
Well, I guess just follow up. Again, we operate from our perspectives, from where we sit, and every day we receive recommendations from agencies and departments saying, here's the changes we need in the statute to operate more efficiently, more effectively. Every day, the departments bring those to us. And again, as chair of campaign finance reform, as a member of this committee, I haven't seen those. And so from where I'm sitting in this seat, that's my perspective.
Senator Johnson, may I?
Please.
Representative Smith. Campaign finance reform should not be part of this discussion, because that's not part of the agency responsibility. That's an elections division function. And I think there's been confusion in the campaign finance reform committee about what campaign finance reform actually is. So if your concerns about campaign finance reform, you really need to have that discussion with the Secretary of State's office. In terms of the agency, I think that's it's a very good idea to have the recommendation. The more training, and the idea that you had to come into the legislature is an excellent idea. These laws are terribly hard to understand. Sarah and I look at them all the time and say, wait, what does this really mean? But I still think you need to have the agency was asked to hold by the governor in the law commission report. I don't know. I was unhappy about that. I don't know how they felt about that.
Does that conclude your comments, Ms. Miller?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Ms. Weatherson.
For the record, I'm Sarah Weatherson with the Money in Politics Research Action Project, and I have some written testimony that I think will cover anything that I wanted to say, but I did want to say I really appreciated the extraordinary opportunity that you gave me last week to speak, and you allowed me to leave with questions on the table. I wanted to return to see if you wanted me to address those here. I have attempted to address them in the written testimony that you're receiving right now, but would be happy to continue now. And I also want to say I appreciate the conversation that you have opened up about the function of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. And
Well, what I can do at this point, Ms. Weatherson, and again, I apologize. We went on in our discussion a little longer with Mr. Hearn than I should have allowed to have happen when there were people waiting to testify. I know that you have a keen interest in this issue. Common Cause does. The counties and cities also have a keen interest in what it is we're talking about. And I will make the commitment to you as chair of this committee that you'll have ample opportunity to continue to engage with the committee as we move through the GSPC budget discussions. Again, on behalf of the committee, I apologize for keeping you sitting in the audience. If you have nothing to add to your written remarks, I will leave the door open for you to appear before the committee again if you have additional comments you'd like to make part of the record.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I have no additional remarks at this time.
Okay. Any comments from the committee before we conclude? Mr. Rocco, any guidance for us as we prepare for next week?
Madam Chair, just to point out that you also have with you the 2005-07 Governor's Recommended Budget Binder for the agency, which has details in it regarding the two packages in the budget that describe the addition of a 0.2 FTE to bring the support position back to full-time status, the agency's only support position, and then another package that would add one full-time investigator position, which are the only additions to the budget. the governor's recommended budget.
Thank you. Then, given that we have run out of committee time, I am going to close the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5033, the Government Standards and Practice Commission. We will take this up on Monday.
Madam Chair, actually, this is going to be held until Phase 3, which would be later in May, probably, before we get back to this budget.
Then I stand corrected with respect to the schedule. We will hold this for Phase 3. I renew my invitation to local government, Common Cause, and Ms. Weatherston to continue to appear before the committee. And unless there is objection from the committee, we stand adjourned.
So maybe we're going to be doing that.